The stories we tell ourselves aren't necessarily the ones that end up shaping the future. We see dots and try to connect them, but we miss other dots that together form a very different picture. And once we think we know the picture, we might not consider other factors that don't fit into it, like in the last U.S. presidential election, or in China, which now seems, against expectations, to be doing a U-turn back towards strongman rule. That's one cautionary tale from a place I've covered as a foreign correspondent. This episode is about another. It's about a place where democratic promise has been thwarted, promising new technological tools misused, old prejudices stirred up, and misinformation spread with deadly effect. It's about taking a closer look at all those overlooked dots. This is Whose Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead. And this episode is about Myanmar, or Burma, as it was called until its military leaders changed its name in 1989, and as it's still called by many Burmese. You'll hear both names in this episode. Few things are simple in Myanmar's political landscape, especially when it comes to how the Rohingya Muslim population has been treated and why, but also when it comes to a whole lot of other things, aspirations for democracy, and what that means in a country with 60 million people and 135 ethnic groups, economic opening and who prospers from it, racism and Islamophobia, the extent to which the Burmese military was ever really prepared to give up substantial amounts of power, China's influence, and disappointment that a pro-democracy icon and Nobel Peace laureate, Aung San Suu Kyi, has turned out to be an all-too-human politician.
I understand that many of our friends throughout the world are concerned by reports of villages being burned and of hordes of refugees fleeing. We too are concerned.
This is Aung San Suu Kyi speaking to Myanmar's parliament in late September 2017. By then, a military ethnic cleansing of Rohingya Muslims from Rakhine State was well underway, with people being killed, women raped, and villages burned down. Note how in this address, Aung San Suu Kyi never mentions the word Rohingya. The military doesn't like the name being used because it says it bestows legitimacy on the group. It calls the Rohingya illegal Bengalis, despite evidence that many Rohingyas can trace their roots in Rakhine State to the 8th century. About 1,000 years before the Burmese army invaded and took it over. Even before this latest purge started, Rohingyas were not allowed to vote in the 2015 election, and Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy party didn't field a single Muslim candidate, despite having many long-standing, loyal Muslim members. Aung San Suu Kyi was elected and became state counselor, a position she calls above the president, a position created specifically for her for a limited 5-year period, since the constitution the military drafted a decade ago prohibits someone married to a foreigner or with children holding foreign passports to become Myanmar's president. That was aimed straight at Aung San Suu Kyi. Her late husband was British, and so are her 2 sons. Even with Aung San Suu Kyi in that position, the military retains considerable control. Back to that speech in September 2017.
We want to find out what the real problems are. There have been allegations and counter-allegations, and we have to listen to all of them. And we have to make sure that these allegations are based on solid evidence before we take action. Action will be taken against all peoples, regardless of their religion, race, or political position, who go against the laws of the land and who violate human rights as accepted by our international community.
Notice also that Aung San Suu Kyi here makes it sound like there may be an equivalence of violence, that many sides may have culpability, when, in fact, the only violence committed by Rohingya Muslims has been 2 attacks, almost a year apart, by a few hundred villagers armed with knives and sticks and homemade bombs, in which a total of 26 security officers died and more than twice that many of the attackers. But since then, thousands of Rohingya have been killed in military-led attacks. Doctors Without Borders estimates at least 6,800 have died, and more than 700,000, two-thirds of all Rohingya in Myanmar, have been forced to flee to Bangladesh. Many international human rights groups and U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson have called this ethnic cleansing. The UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in Myanmar, Yang-Hee Lee, has said this military-led campaign against the Rohingya has the hallmarks of genocide. Still, almost 6 months after Aung San Suu Kyi's pledge that all abusers of human rights will be punished, no one has been punished for what they've done to the Rohingya Muslims. How did it come to this? Just 6 or 7 years ago, Myanmar was a good news story. It was opening up, moving toward reforms, reducing poverty, and increasing economic opportunity. More than 30 million Burmese got smartphones within 3 years and became better connected to each other and the world. Well, beneath the surface, there were old fault lines, like Islamophobia and racism, and the military exploited those. Muslims make up just 4% of Myanmar's population. About 90% are Buddhists. But the story was spread on social media that Muslims aimed to take over the country and that Buddhists needed to defend it. The military worked with a Buddhist monk named Ashin Wirathu, who'd spent time in prison for hate speech. They also recruited other Buddhist monks to this cause of protecting Myanmar's race and religion. Why Buddhist monks? Well, the military had seen the power of Buddhist monks leading pro-democracy demonstrations in 1988 and again in 2007. Subverting some of them to an anti-Muslim cause was kind of dark political genius. Myanmar's military has long had it in for the Rohingya. It launched one violent purge against them in the late 70s, causing 200,000 to flee. Many came back. Then again in the early 90s, 250,000 fled. Many came back. There's also been a military-led purge ever since 2012. Homes have been burned down. Rohingya have been put in effectively internment camps in Rakhine. And others have been forced onto boats at gunpoint and towed into the open sea, where they were abandoned. But none of that came close to what's happened since late August 2017. It started with that attack by a few hundred poorly armed villagers on security posts in Rakhine. The Burmese military said it had a crackdown to fight terrorism, that there was an Islamist extremist group behind these attacks, the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army, or ARSA. But there's a lot that's murky here. ARSA did claim responsibility for the two attacks in October 2016 and August 2017. But it says its fight is not Islamist, but for Rohingya rights. And even then, it's unclear how much support it actually has among Rohingya. Some have even raised suspicions, controversial and unproven ones, that ARSA was actually created by the Burmese military so it would have an excuse to purge Rohingyas from Myanmar. It does seem a little extreme to drive out hundreds of thousands of Rohingyas because of attacks by a few hundred. And why would the military be so focused on doing that just at this moment? Hard to know, but it's worth noting that a major Chinese oil pipeline cuts through Rakhine State, with another one planned. There are also major Indian and Chinese deepwater ports on Rakhine's western coast, and China plans to spend $1 trillion in infrastructure projects in neighboring countries to link them all to China in the One Belt, One Road initiative. Rakhine, with its long coastline, could become a lucrative center for such projects. Interesting, then, that in January and February 2018, the Burmese military brought in bulldozers and backhoes to clear the charred remains of Rohingya houses and to level village vegetation. Under Burmese law, land that has been cleared of structures and vegetation reverts to state ownership. Coincidence? Who knows? But it is pretty clear that this purge hasn't cost the military much domestically. No action, even verbal sanction by the civilian pro-democracy government. In fact, much of the Burman Buddhist majority seems to actually support the purging of the Rohingyas. There's even talk that the head of the armed forces, General Minong Lang, might run for president in a couple of years on the popularity of having led the purge. In the face of all of this, it's not an easy time to be a Burmese pro-democracy and human rights advocate, as is my guest for this episode, Kin Omar. A quick note, the name Omar might sound like it's Muslim, which is relevant since we're talking here about Rohingya Muslims. She's actually an ethnic Burman and is Buddhist and is deeply concerned about what's happening with the Rohingya. And here's another note, you'll hear both Rohingya and Rohingya in this episode. Rohingya is how Burmese say the word. Rohingya is what the group calls itself.
The situation of the Rohingya people in Burma, or those who are already in refugee camps on the Bangladesh border, it's quite unspeakable, the suffering that they have to endure with. Because, first of all, in Burma, they are not recognized as a part of the society. Their citizenship been deprived for many, many years. There are also institutionalized discrimination towards them for a long time, meaning like they're not able to have freedom of travel in the country. They're not able to have access to any, you know, like social services, including the health and education. Throughout my life, the majority people or the many different communities in the country under the military regime in the past, since 1962, don't know the Rohingya people exist because it is an intentional state policy.
So you're saying that when you were growing up, you yes. weren't aware that there were Rohingya people in Burma?
That's correct. That's correct. I was not aware of it until the first time I come to learn about the Rohingya people was back in 1992. I was already in the United States, and I was working with the Refugees International in Washington, D.C. And that was the first influx of the Rohingya refugees to the Bangladesh border that I've come to learn. And then of course, you know, like I did more research and more inquiry, and the first time that they were driven out was back in 1978 under the operation called the King of Dragon Operation, led by General Ne Win's military regime. Their citizenship have been stripped off for all along those years because we have this very discriminatory citizenship law of 1982, really designed to discriminate the minorities population, particularly the Rohingya population has been always targeted with that. In the past, there were Rohingya politicians. There were also Rohingya broadcasting. The Burmese Broadcasting Service had the Rohingya language program.
When was that?
It was in 1950s and also up until, basically, you know, these all things gone after General Ne Win took military coup in 1962. But before that, there were Rohingya politicians, Rohingya policemen, Rohingya in the civil servants, teachers, all of like, they are a part of the whole society, basically. But that's all started to be all gone after 1962.
So is that because the military has always been very nationalistic, like Burman nationalistic?
The military always been Burman nationalistic. Rohingyas are not the only one who've been targeted. The Kachins, the Chin, the Karen, the Shan, basically those different ethnic nationalities or ethnic communities of Burma who came together to form this federal union to get the independence from British. The political accord of 1947 for the independence was that we will form this union together on the equal terms. You know, nobody is above the others. But that didn't go well. The military always, their doctrine is to force every other communities to become under one identity, one religion. It's like a Buddhist Burma.
So in 1947, Aung San was the head of the military, and then he was assassinated. Yes. Was he pro the rights of minorities?
Well, because we didn't have a chance to see him actually apply his policies because he was assassinated. It's hard to say, but from his approach to the ethnic communities for the independence, and from his speeches, you can see that he appreciate and praise and respect the diversity. And he doesn't like this chauvinist majority kind of approach. So from his speeches, we don't see him do that. But when he tried to get the independence from the British, he actually went to London alone. Only because British said, you don't represent the ethnic people. So basically the British said, we cannot give you independence unless we hear from the other ethnics. So General Aung San came back and actually went to meet with the ethnic communities. From his public speeches and his public stand, he was not bad. That's what we can say.
Ne Win, on the other hand.
Ne Win, on the other hand, is very different. Also, the irony about General Ne Win is he is actually Chinese descendant. He's not even any of the local original communities of this country. But he definitely started these discriminatory practices. It became a policy. So basically, for the Rohingya or the Muslims, some of them were in the army and in the police and no longer. But also, interesting point is, when they were no longer given that kind of space, the other ethnic people like the Kachin or the Karen, you know, particularly mostly who are the Christians, they are still allowed to join, like the army and police. But if they want to get promotion, they have to change their name to the Burmese name, or some have to convert to the Buddhism. Only if they become to be a part of the Buddhist Burma, they get promotion or they get trust and confidence from these army generals. And that's been going on for many generations, you know.
When you were growing up, you didn't hear about the Rohingya, but were you kind of taught in school or through other means, through the media or whatever, that to be Burman is to be superior to other ethnicities in the country?
In the school curriculum, the text or the poems or lyrics or examples of the students who have to learn is all referring to the Buddhism. There is nothing about the Christianity. There's nothing about the Hinduism or Islam. Nothing about the other cultures or the other identities, except, you know, like about 7 or 8 major groups, ethnic groups we call as national races, name. But especially when you get into the textbooks of the history subject, it's all about the Burman kings conquering the other places. Or the Burman kingdom fall into Japan or British or, you know, like, you know, Chinese-Burmese war or things like that. But there's nothing about the other ethnic communities. And also when we go to the public schools, it doesn't matter what faith you're from, you have to actually take the 5 precepts of the Buddhism in the morning. It's a sutra, you have to say it out loud in the morning. Many schools have that. So even my friends who are from the Christian or, you know, Islam, if they attend these schools, that's what they have to do.
I mean, when I think of Buddhism, I think of a philosophy or a religious practice that encourages at its essence compassion and tolerance.
Yes.
And it just seems like such an oxymoron that there would be Buddhist nationalists. Mm. And yet that's what we're talking about now. That's what we're seeing in Burma now.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, what you see right now, the rising Buddhist ultranationalism, doesn't reflect all the Buddhists in the country. The Buddhism in Burma has been politicized and misused by the successive military regimes for so long, especially starting from General Ngwin time. It is under the direct control and scrutiny of the military regime, where the highest monks have to accommodate to the calls from the military. When the young Buddhist monks took themselves to the streets back 10 years ago in 2007, when they were calling for the people, they were basically shot and killed on the streets by the military. One thing about the current Buddhism, in my observation, I mean, I am a Buddhist, a majority of how the Buddhism is practiced in the country is come to be so dependent on praying rather than actually with their own actions. In Buddhism, karma is actually based on your own actions. But now that's been misinterpreted by, like, karma is like, if you didn't do good things in the past, everything you are suffering in this life is because you didn't do good things in the past. But everything you do now in next 5 minutes, already a past. That is like present, past, and future for Buddhism. It's not about your past life and the whole current life, you know? So I think there is a lot of this misinterpretation. And people actually fall on the trap that if they want to have a good life, is to just listen to the Buddhist monks and then just donate to the pagodas rather than sharing to the needing people, you know, in the neighborhood. It's become also, rather than being socially engaged and taking responsible, it become more inactive and relying and dependent on the religious leaders rather than trying to understand the Buddha's teaching. I mean, for me, being a human rights activist, I have come to be working with the different communities who want to actually understand what is that their rights that they are entitled and how their rights are being deprived, but also how they can actually document these rights are being deprived.
And in which parts of the country?
It's in different parts of the country.
Rakhine in particular?
Including the Rakhine, but also in the mainland, we call the central, because that's where the Burma majority lives. That's also where you have now at least 23 villages or the areas, communities, where they publicly put a billboard, like right entrance to their village or their area, saying that no Indians or no Muslims are allowed. And some say that these are Muslim-free zones. So these are the areas where this ultra-nationalist Buddhist sentiment is rising more, because, you know, these are more like Christian communities areas. In fact, when I was back in the country in 2014, there are a lot of publications, this Mabada, and their collaborators publish with the different names.
Another quick note, Mabada is the Burmese abbreviation for a group that in English has been called the Patriotic Association of Burma or the Association for the Defense of Race and Religion. It's an association of Buddhist monks that had operated with the military up until when it was banned by the state-run Buddhist authority in July last year. But there are still right-wing anti-Muslim Buddhist monks like Wirathu who continue to speak out.
And these publications are sold on the streets and go to everywhere. And in those publications, there are a lot of hate speech, particularly targeting the Muslim community. And also a lot of intimidation and harassment to anybody who advocate for the minorities' rights. For example, like even myself, my photo was run in those publications where I am labeled as national traitor because I advocate for the Rohingyas or Muslims, or, you know. But people like us, we are actually targeted with our photos being published or receiving the SMS messages or the like messengers on the Facebook or writing on the Facebook, like intimidating and threatening us, for example. And even in like, you know, in one of the cases that I have come to learn from my colleagues is that they saw photos of a few of us in one of the monastery, Mabada, you know, monastery, like we are being labeled as the national traitors, that we need to be punished. I have seen and watched also some of the VCDs where the Buddhist monks actually preaching to the people.
DVDs.
So there are like hundreds of these DVDs are sold on the street, for example. And if you actually pick up and watch them, you will see that Buddhist monks are really like spreading this hate speech, hatred towards the Muslims, comparing them with the dogs, insects, worms. The language that they use is so discriminatory, labeling like, you know, Muslims are like animals. They breed rather than they give birth. A lot of things like that is being spread a lot to the general public. And one thing we have to also understand from the general public's situation, this is the 50 million population country under the military regime for more than 60 years with very poor education. Even that most of the general public are not able to have access to. So meaning that the people only follow the Buddhist monks and they take everything come from Buddhist monks as truth. And then when they have no exposure to the others, so it's so easy to manipulate their brain or like brainwash them, you know?
It's so chilling because it has so many echoes of what happened in Rwanda, you know, where the Hutus were calling the Tutsis cockroaches and otherizing them and making them sound like they weren't even human. And there was the use of public media to get people to get used to thinking a certain way about how you needed to protect yourself and your people and your rights against these non-humans.
Yeah, actually some of us who are, you know, walking on the ground are very worried. I mean, knowing of what happened in Rwanda, also like in near to our country is Cambodia. The level of violence the Rohingya community already face is already a living evidence for us already now. And if you go back even only like 5 years ago in 2012, in central Burma, there was a town called Maitila. I mean, this, the whole area is the Buddhist Burma majority area. But yes, there are also a smaller community like the Muslims are there. And when the violence happened, it was scary because people get set on fire, for example. You can even see like how the witnesses or collaborators who can give out such kind of information, what kind of like a reprisal that they can face, not only from this kind of general public, you know, who have this nationalist sentiment, but also from the state. I mean, look at the case of these two writers, reporters who were actually arrested December, and the villagers who gave them information about the mass killing that the Burma army now admitted that there was a killing, mass killing of 10 Rohingya villagers. We don't even know. We know where the two Reuters reporters are, but we don't...
The Reuters reporters.
Yeah, but we don't know where are those four villagers and two policemen who collaborated or gave out the information to them. They are already taken away by the authorities, but nobody knows where they are whereabouts. So people are very worried. And there is also a lot of self-censorship in terms of what they say and they don't say.
Are you personally worried about your safety?
Actually, I encountered one experience just a few months ago while I was speaking at the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva. I read a statement in which I said what happened to the Rohingya people. It's an ethnic cleansing. And I learned all the Burmese media in the country translated my statement and they broadcast. And soon after that, a lot of these attacks and coming, you know, through the social media. Like, if you're not in the country, you're a little bit better. But depends on where I am. A lot of things can happen. So, yeah, I am careful than before. But, of course, this will not stop what I'm doing because we still need to speak up. What is happening is so wrong. But also, if we want to see our society, people to live in the peaceful way, there's no other way. I mean, like this, for me, being a Buddhist and belonging to the Burma majority, I even feel more responsible. I should be able to amplify those voices from the ground, whether they are from the oppressed, persecuted minority communities, or whether they are from my own majority community who want to do the right thing, but under the circumstances, they are more at risk than me to be able to say the or do the right things in the country openly. So for me, it's this time, it's... How do we find different channels to educate this majority Buddhist public and sensitizing them to come to understand that they are being trapped in this military propaganda and that they have to actually respect the others? This is one thing we are trying to get to them is if you want to protect your religion, it's actually not by insulting or discriminating the other religions. Is by respecting the other religions and appreciating and recognizing them. How do we get this message to the general public? Because now in Burma, majority of the people, they have their smartphones now, they use the Facebook, and this Facebook has become a very successful propaganda tool for the military and these nationalist groups. They are able to send out all these hate speech, provoke and instigate the violence, and they've been successful because people who use the Facebook are those mostly like undereducated general public who will only read and just take everything as genuine, authentic news or information rather than giving it a doubt with a critical thinking, oh, is it true? So now is for people like us, it is our responsibility. How do we actually help educate this majority, get out of this propaganda machine?
What do you think Aung San Suu Kyi is doing in trying to move things in the right direction?
It's hard to say at this point. I have come to not to be wondering much of where she is now or what she might be doing. I'm saying this is because the crisis that this country is facing, many of these crises are actually resulted from the military. And at the moment, for Aung San Suu Kyi, since she has come to be a part of this government, you know, she's under the 2008 constitution, meaning that's under the military's control. It doesn't matter how much of the goodwill she has, or it doesn't matter how much of good intention and thinks that she wants to do the right thing or not. Because at the end of the day, it is the military who has the final say. At the same time, what could have been better is if there were more channels open from her to all the people, you know, different communities. Because in order for her to be effective under the circumstances, under the military control, is by having the people with her and behind her. I think it's difficult for the people to have access to her because right now it really is the military and only the trusted people from her political party. But these two sources alone is never enough for a leader in her position to be able to do the right thing. In the past, she is the moral authority. She is the leader of the people, the moral leader. But she already let us know publicly that she is a politician. She has tend to be a politician. I think it's very clear message. Now, we also take that she is a politician. Meaning, being a politician, if she does things wrong, we should be able to say as wrong. There should be no reservation about it, because for us, it's our responsibility to be able to question or be able to be critical to what the politicians do. That's what democracy is. She has actually welcomed it in the past. I think we have to continue to do that. But I think the challenge now is because she's been all along a moral authority, you know, a leader of the democracy movement and human rights movement and all of that. Many people in the domestic and international sphere, many people look up to her, still until now, look up to her as a moral authority. When she failed from this moral ground, of course, including myself, we all got completely nervous and, you know, shaken up and freaked out and frustrated and heartbroken and all of that. But I think I have come to make that clear that we have to move on. We have to move on. Meaning, when I say we have to move on from Aung San Suu Kyi is when we say what she needs to be done, right, for the people. If she doesn't, we should be able to say that she is not able to do it.
It sounds like it's really a difficult time for Burmans who want to do the right thing. And I say Burmans meaning ethnic Burmese who are the majority in Burma, Myanmar, because Aung San Suu Kyi for 25, 30 years was considered to be sort of a moral center. And Buddhist monks for centuries have been seen to be a moral center. And in both cases, it's just very disorienting to see what's happening.
Yes, it is. It is definitely a disheartening shocking to some extent. You can imagine also among the people come to be divided. Because people who love her and adore her and trust her and support her, take her as a leader, I can imagine that is so hard for them not to be taken the side with her. So you start to see the people divided into one camp who will defend her no matter what she does or no matter what she doesn't. But at the same time, you have another group who sees things as it is and they see that she's not able to move forward. But at the same time, this is the first time in this country's history since 1962 in particular, there is some sort of opening. We need to recognize that too. And because of that opening, people are so afraid of being closed again. And that anxiety is also bringing the people to be more and more silent instead of to be more and more vigilant and more outspoken to embrace this values of democracy and lay the groundwork for democracy with those values that without transparency, without, you know, having a critical and dialogue, you know, open, you know, information, you can't really build a democratic foundation, you know. So the irony is one that is a government led by the people's leader and moral authority of the democratic opposition and a hard time, the people come to be more having self-censorship. I think that's a quite irony. And that all fall in favor for the military. Because now, you know, in many cases, they don't need to use the violence to suppress the freedom of expression or freedom of opinion. People have their own self-censorship because Aung San Suu Kyi is there. So I think it's a quite a very tricky moment for this country. Many people will say that Burma is going through a transition. It is to some extent, but I think it really is the army who is still remain in power until unless this current constitution is changed. In 2020, we're having another election. It's important for the world to understand that Aung San Suu Kyi's current position comes from a law. That law was able to pass immediately only because her party won landslide and became the majority in the parliament. And this law for her to take this state councillor position lasts only 5 years. So if we only depend on Aung San Suu Kyi, this country is going to be facing more and more challenging time because under such circumstances, she won't be able to do much.
Well, and beyond that, although she's not extremely old, she's also not very young. you know, so she's not going to be around forever. Anyway, there have to be younger people who are coming up who are willing to step in and show leadership and take the risks that will come with trying to build a civilian government and to work with the military and try to persuade them or pressure them or both to cede some power.
Yeah, you're right. This country definitely desperately needs the second line leadership or the young generation of leaders to bring the country to the right democratic transition path. My only worry right now is because of this rising ultra-Buddhist nationalism. Many, including the amateur or somewhat experienced politicians, particularly from the Buddhist Burma majority, started to see the nationalist ideology is the vote-winning card for them. And that, to me, is very scary.
So people who are saying, let's get rid of more of these ethnic minorities, let's not have them in the country, or let's make sure there are laws and regulations that keep them as second-class citizens, if citizens at all.
I would say they are second and third-class citizens. So when the Buddhist Burma majority look at the other minority communities, you know, like the Kachins and the Shans and the Karen, they are taken as more second-class. But when it comes to the Rohingya and Muslims and, you know, other like a Chinese descendant generations living in this country for so long, these are all like a third class or even lower.
The Chinese are third class?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Nay Win was of Chinese descent?
Yes, yes. But even in that third class citizenship status, the degree of the actual discrimination practice is different. For the Chinese community, I think because of their wealth, and also, to me, it's all about the racism. For example, like the Chinese are not seen as quote-unquote dirty. It's because of their fair skin complexion.
But you said they're still third class.
Yes, they're third class. Whereas any Indian descendants, because of their dark skin kind of like complexion, they are taken even more farther down. But then the interesting point is the Burmese are actually dark skinned too. So again, like, where did that come from, you know? If you go back to that General Nay Win time, even in the media, like I was like going through some of the information, and he was already like using the word like pure blood. National races are those who have pure blood. And we're like, who has the pure blood in this country anyway or anywhere else in this world? I mean, it's just such a delusion, you know, that's been built around this identity.
Is this a long-standing thing, or is this something that the army drummed up very intentionally to try to cement its hold on power?
Army drummed up and cemented based on that historical situation. I mean, it just didn't come out of the blue. Before the British or any of these colonial time came in, the Burma kings were the one who were already colonizing the others. Even the Burma king came to Thailand. They took Ayodhya. They destroyed the Thai kingdom, basically. And they took the Mon kingdom. They took the Rakhine kingdom. Like, they took, what does it mean? It's a military operation. Even like the Buddhism came to Burma, actually to the Mon people first, to Mon kingdom first. So the colonialization didn't start in Burma with British. There was a colonialization by the Burma kings before already. I mean, if you go, you will see these big statues with the sword on the horse. And if you look at who are those people, these are the Burma kings in the past who conquered the Mon kingdom or the Ayodhya or the Rakhine kingdom. Basically, that's what happened. So the Burma army doctrine of nation-building ideology rooted from that. So that is why now you are seeing that their ideology is for the ethnic groups like the Kachin or the Mon or the Shan. Give up the armed struggle, you come under us, and we'll give you some rights. But what does it mean by the some rights, right? So basically, for them, is they will take the land, and they have been doing that, and they will take the natural resources, and they've been doing that. And not only that, they will only use the Burmese language as the national language, where the ethnic languages will not be treated equally, because for them, one identity, one religion.
And they're saying this to ethnic minorities that have been fighting for autonomy and for the right to continue their culture and their language for 70 or 80 years, you know, on the borders of Thailand and China.
Yes, even just in last a few months, they said it again, publicly, out loud. The nationwide ceasefire agreement that's been signed since 2015, that nationwide ceasefire agreement is meant only for the ethnic armed groups to give up their arms and come under the political fold, just to form the political party and come under the 2008 constitution. Burma Army doesn't compromise. They are not going to back out. So all Aung San Suu Kyi's efforts for peace and also the international peace donors, including the U.S. government, giving out all these millions and billions of dollars to this peace process in Burma, it stalled. It is failed, actually. The nationwide ceasefire agreement is not even nationwide. It's only like 8 organizations sign it, whereas you have like 20 plus are still not signing it yet or not allowed to sign by the Burma Army. One thing that we have to also understand this Burma Army is that in order for them to maintain in politics or, you know, take control of the country, they still need to make sure that there are conflict, and they will make sure that there is always conflict.
It was 30 years ago this year that you and many other Burmese were out in the streets calling for democracy. And by August of that year, Aung San Suu Kyi had become a leader for people who wanted democracy and just basically a more tolerant society, not ruled primarily by the military. 30 years later, as you look at the next 30 years in Burma, what do you think the chances are that your country will be able to achieve that goal?
What turned out now after 30 years in this opening time is not what I expected 100%. But then I was already expecting a lot of fault lines under the surface will come out when the country opened up. Because we are so diverse, religiously, ethnically, that's first. Second, we never had a chance to build this society to be one, because all along, that's always been the forced narrative that we are all together and one and the same. That's what the military tried all along when they manipulate and exploit for their own benefit, for their personal benefit, really. When you have all these problems under the carpet, if you want to address them, you need to bring them up. Negligence and pretending that they don't exist never work. To me, with all of these crises, particularly for the Rohingya people, as much as I never wanted this happen ever to them, at least if we couldn't prevent the latest catastrophe, I don't want another, you know, catastrophe to them again. Also for the long term, how do we not only try to bring the humanitarian aid to the Rohingya people on the ground, but also try to get this majority to understand that this country's history being distorted all along, that they've been deprived from knowing the truth of the existence of all of our communities on this land, that everybody come from somewhere, that nobody is indigenous on this land. I mean, it's so obvious, of course. It breaks my heart also, 30 years of my human rights, democracy, activism. We call for human rights, we call for democracy, but it's now very clear that we don't know what we're calling for. It's really heartbreaking for me. You know, like, I mean, I have done many of like hundreds of trainings on human rights and democracy, but now it came to be a bitter, painful realization that we're not near anywhere to that. And of course, saying that, now it would take more of a double and triple efforts for us to keep trying.
Ken Omar, thanks for joining me on Whose Century Is It?
Thank you for also giving me the chance to share my thoughts.
Comments, questions, suggestions for future episodes? Drop me an email at whosecentury@gmail.com or send a message on Twitter. I'm at Mary Kay Magstad, that's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. If you haven't already subscribed to the podcast, please do, and tell your friends, family, anyone you know who's interested in thinking about interesting ways to think about the future. You can check out the archive. There are almost 60 past episodes at whosecenturyisit.com or on the podcast legacy page, pri.org/century, which includes essays and photos. Back soon with another episode. Thanks for listening.